Dr. Lester Grinspoon has just published a book called Marijuana Reconsidered, wherein he maintains that, in fact, modern science knows enough about marijuana to permit us to devise a sensible social policy concerning the use of it. Dr. Grinspoon got his medical degree from Harvard and is now associate clinical professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. He has written, edited, or contributed to several dozen books, symposia, and articles on diverse matters of medical and psychological concern, including my favorite essay, quotes, telemetered heart rate and skin potential of a hallucinating chronic schizophrenic patient. We have also with us a young man who several years ago undertook to develop a drug education program, his thesis then being that above all things we need to distribute what knowledge we have about drugs. The Creative Learning Group, which he heads, puts out audiovisual and other material for use in grammar schools and high schools. Mr. McKinney is himself a graduate of Harvard and of the Harvard Business School. He began his postgraduate career by teaching English at the University of North Carolina, but along the way he decided that the absence of general information about drugs required immediate action, which he has sought to give it. Dr. Grinspoon, we had on this program a while ago Mr. John Kaplan, whose book calling for the legalization of marijuana, you're no doubt aware of. Mr. Kaplan is a lawyer, not a doctor, and he said that if he had it in his power to destroy the potential to produce marijuana, he would gladly exercise that power to that effect. I should like to begin by asking you whether your findings lead you to believe that we are better off legalizing marijuana because we are powerless to prevent its use, or do you go further and welcome the existence of marijuana?
No, I think the former position is closer to mine, that I think we are powerless to prevent its use. I think the history of psychoactive drugs has demonstrated this from really the time of the introduction of the cigarette in the 17th century, that we simply have not been able to contain the use of psychoactive drugs through criminal penalties.
And therefore, if someone were to succeed in persuading you that by a combination of pressures, legal, social, and evangelical, it could be possible to persuade everybody who might use marijuana not to use it, that is where your energies would be devoted?
Well, if one could persuade people, let's say, through education, that a certain drug is deleterious to one's health, and people respond to education and so forth, but I think I'm afraid that any system that prevents people from using a psychoactive drug which is not educational and rehabilitative and so forth, the cost is simply too high for me.
So
the social cost.
I see. So therefore, like Mr. Kaplan, you're not pro marijuana.
No, I'm not trying to push marijuana. What I'm concerned with is it seems clear to me now that that marijuana is a harmful drug in the sense that any psychoactive drug is a harmful drug. But if one puts it...
How do you define psychoactive? Is alcohol psychoactive?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
How about cigarettes?
Yes.
Is Coca-Cola?
Coca-Cola has enough caffeine that it might be considered a psychoactive drug.
How about lemon squash?
I don't believe so, but I'm not familiar with it.
Well, then everything is psychoactive.
Well, no, but lots of things are, more things than most people suspect. But the point is that it's not that I'm saying that marijuana is a harmless drug, but that, in fact, its harmfulness, that the harmfulness deriving from its psychopharmacological properties, the harm arising from these properties is far less than the harm which we are imposing on young people through the present approach to its social use.
Well, that again is the Kaplan argument. I'm not suggesting that you can't share the argument, but there's room enough for both of you. But now, what about those who say that in point of fact, marijuana, since it is less harmful, so they say, than, let's say, alcohol, it might actually prevent a lot of people from the ravages of alcohol if they are carefully introduced to it. Would you go so far as to say, well, for instance, if you had a son and your choice were introducing him to alcohol or to marijuana, and you had to do one or the other, which of the two would you choose?
Oh, clearly marijuana.
You would.
Now, I would rather he didn't use either, but if he had to use one, I'd prefer him to use marijuana, and I'll tell you why. First of all, alcohol is an addicting drug. A very significant percentage of people who use alcohol do become addicted to it. As far as marijuana is concerned, it is not an addicting drug. Now, it's true that...
There are some people who disagree.
There are some people... Well, I don't think they can disagree, really. I don't think there are really many medical sources who would disagree with the statement that it is not an addicting drug. There are people who say it leads to psychological dependence. And that's perfectly true. There are a small number of people who, the so-called potheads, who really become very dependent on the drug and sort of orient their lives around it. But even so, if I had to deal with an alcoholic versus a pothead, I would sooner deal with a pothead because, one, his liver and other parts of his gastrointestinal system are not being harmed, nor is his cardiovascular and central nervous system. Alcohol does cause cellular damage in these tissues. And two, he is, after all, on a drug which is not addicting. Now, the alcoholic, let's say he's treated for the personality disorder or the depression or whatever it is that compels him to use so much alcohol to sort of anesthetize himself. If he can be treated for this underlying emotional difficulty, he's still left with an addiction. He's also left with some cell damage. Whereas the pothead, if one can... Again, if he can overcome whatever it is that makes it necessary for him to orient his life...
He emerges whole.
He emerges whole.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's quite a difference. And he can emerge from it without being stuck on an addicting drug. And in fact, many potheads do. Also, it seems clear, there's a study coming that will be published out of UCLA that demonstrates that there are probably only about 1 or 2% of people who use marijuana become potheads. The number of people who use alcohol socially become alcoholic may be as high as 10%.
Well, Ms. McKinney, your experience is also, like Dr. Grinspoon's, theoretical, but it's also, I take it, based on a close observation of people who have used these drugs, or is your concern primarily with how simply to devise techniques by which to relay the kind of thing that Dr. Grinspoon is talking about?
I think you probably hit the nail right in the head there. When I was in college in the early days of drug experimentation, everybody was experimenting with these drugs, and I was curious as to what the effects were and how they were being caused. But more than that, I was really concerned about why some kinds of people really did seem to get dependent on drugs. What was causing it? Not so much, you know, the pharmacological basis, but why would a person turn down his life by using alcohol or barbiturates? Why would a person seek some kind of fulfillment with hallucinogens or so on? And it never seemed to be answered very well easily. It always seemed to be a personal thing. And it seemed to me that by scapegoating the drug, by saying that this marijuana will come into your life and make your son into a hippie, was begging the question that if we understood what the drugs were, then perhaps we could eliminate them as a causal factor and understand why the person went to the drug and to start learning them.
But isn't this a rationalist superstition? I take it, for instance, that doctors are in a position to know better than anybody else how harmful tobacco is and how harmful certain kinds of drugs are.
Mm-hmm.
And yet doctors are among the members of the smoking community, for instance.
Much less so than they used to be.
Less so, well...
Much, much, much less so.
Would you say less so than engineers?
I don't have any data on that, but I'm confident that doctors are smoking much less than they used to. In fact, it's estimated in the last 4 years, despite a rather low-key anti-tobacco campaign, 10 million Americans over the last 4 years, or 10 million have quit smoking.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clear that doctors are smoking less out of proportion than other people because they are very much aware of the dangers.
Well, the notion that the mere knowledge of the kind of things that you both talk about is going to cause people not to turn to marijuana is itself, isn't it, a rationalist superstition?
Well, I don't think so. I think
rather example, we have to do what we can,
right.
but it doesn't
well,
follow.
I don't think it will solve the problem, mind you, but I think it's for example, when the LSD reports on chromosomal breakage were published, there was an enormous drop.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it turned out, that they were wrong. But, I mean, kids did respond to those reports. I don't believe that...
But didn't it respond really from word-of-mouth reports of bad trips rather than any theoretical knowledge?
I'd have to interject there and say that wasn't really true because in the underground in drug use, the bad trip is about 2-5%. Most of them had perfectly fine trips. And this was the word of mouth thing that went around, really, that if you had a bad trip, it was your own fault. That you were ill-prepared, you were frightened, you were distrustful. And for some reason, you had ill-prepared yourself for your trip. When the chromosomal damage thing came out, a lot of things did start happening. For instance, this argument, is information going to help? It's going to help. We've held that drug abuse, and I'm trying to separate drug abuse from drug use, occasional drug use, like, a drink before dinner is against drinking all day. Drug abuse is almost always a compound of frustration or unhappiness with ignorance. They think somehow that this drug is going to make them happier somehow. And we can't do anything about human frustration and human misery. We can, individually we can. But if people know about these dangers, obviously, like Dr. Grinson was mentioning, the Surgeon General's report on tobacco or the business about chromosomal damage, we won't have to go through the horrible drawn-out information flow. Speed, for instance, is being used far, far less on the streets now, but only because so many people are so ravaged. It did become known in the streets that speed was going.
How do you account for the rise in the use of heroin?
I think that it's like that again. The drugs that first started being used, marijuana, because people had heard it was so exciting, and then they discovered it wasn't as harmful as they'd been told. And using this as their rationale, they went on to hallucinogens, those who wanted a more intense trip, and some went on to barbiturates and narcotics. The only statistics I have for heroin were something like that, 65% of people who used it once did not use it again. But those who did use it again had found something. That there are a certain percentage in any population who seek that kind of oblivion. And if it's available, they will try it, no matter what they're told.
See, I think if Mr. McKinney's programs had been around, let's say, in Vietnam, I think that there would be less of a problem with heroin there. I think part of the problem has been miseducation, that drugs, everything's lumped together. Marijuana, heroin, LSD, and so forth. For example, there are fewer officers in Vietnam, although many of them have used marijuana. Few of them are stuck on heroin. The enlisted man is the person who's largely stuck on heroin. I think the reason is the officer is more sophisticated. He's learned a little more that marijuana is different from heroin. I think many of the young people, young troopers in Vietnam who got stuck on heroin simply... A large part of it was ignorance. They were told that marijuana was dangerous and so forth. They discovered for themselves that it did not have disastrous effects on them. Opium was available, well, they were told that was dangerous too. In fact, it was lumped into the same kind of it's all drug in a sort of generic sense. And I think out of sheer ignorance, many of them used opium.
Have you actually studied the literature distributed by the army in Vietnam?
I have not actually studied the literature.
You simply assume that it dealt with them all equally?
Yeah. Well, in reading John Steinbeck's book, I gather he certainly studied the literature, and I gathered from that book that they were all just lumped, as they are generally in this country, drugs are lumped together, they have been. In fact, it puts the drug educator in a very difficult position, because, if he... tells his young students candidly about the relative dangers of marijuana, LSD, heroin, alcohol, tobacco, He is very likely to say things which would be quite offensive to the PTA or the school board or what have you, and he might very well lose his job.
Well, look, we've got a situation in which you have just written a book, A Marijuana Reconsidered, in which you simply flatly recommend the legalization of marijuana for people over the age of 18.
With certain controls.
With certain controls. Yeah. And Mr. McKinney has an organization in which he seeks to distribute information of a kind which at least is consistent with your own recommendations. As I understand it, there's nothing in your literature that says you should or shouldn't legalize.
We don't even talk about the legalization. All we say is that marijuana is terribly illegal.
Yeah.
And that nobody should use it because it is illegal, for one reason. And then we point out that, of course, it does detract from a person's ability to concentrate. It does enable a person, if he wants to avoid his work more easily. And for these reasons, aside from the fact that it's illegal, it should be avoided.
Mm-hmm.
We make it perfectly clear that our opinion on marijuana is the fact that, especially in the growing person in the adolescent years, it should be avoided at all costs.
Yeah, okay. Now, the reason I raise this question is because suppose people listening to this program, reading your book, looking at your literature, they say, well, but this is different from a finding of another doctor. Now, I can understand where, ultimately, two experts disagreeing have to submit to a tribunal that is not immediately available. At some point, you become discredited or he becomes discredited. But for so long as there are, of course, responsible doctors who disagree with your medical findings, what is one supposed to do? Is it responsible to go ahead and indulge the presumption that the guy who says it's dangerous ought to be listened to rather than the guy who says it isn't? Or do you have an argument to cope with that?
Well, I really don't have an argument to cope with that, except that I have in my book marshaled the evidence and critically evaluated the data that does exist. And I think that it's perfectly clear, I think, even to most doctors who take a more skeptical view about the relative harmlessness of marijuana than I do, I think it's perfectly clear to them that putting a young person in jail for a number of years, or even putting him on probation, or in any way crippling his career because of this kind of
misbehavior.
One doesn't even have to go to that. I think most of those people would agree that there is nothing in the.
Well, but in what capacity are you talking to us now? Are you talking to us as a doctor, or are you talking to us as a reformer, or are you saying that the two roles are undetachable under the circumstances? For instance, if it had been the early part of the 19th century, you might say, for heaven's sakes, don't hang somebody who steals something worth more than the shilling. It just isn't doing much about theft, and anyway, there are lots of arguments against it. This would have nothing to do with your views about larceny. Now, here, are you urging, as Mr. Kaplan is, that you lower the penalty for marijuana smoking, or are you asking people to adopt a different idea towards it?
Well, what I'm doing is...
I know the answer because I read your book, but I mean...
Well, what I've tried to show in my book, and mind you, I started this research 4 years ago with a negative bias. I thought that the drug was more dangerous than I realized that it is. But what I've tried to show in my book is that when you look at all the evidence that is available now, you simply cannot make a statement that it is more dangerous than alcohol or tobacco. That indeed, if you accept as a reality that people are going to
It doesn't follow, does it, that because it's less dangerous than tobacco than alcohol, it ought to be legalized because alcohol is legalized.
Right.
Alcohol happens to be a national addiction.
Yeah, it's an almost quasi-national drug.
Yeah.
It's almost deviant not to use that drug. But
What I
was going to say that if you accept as a reality that large numbers, we don't live in perfect social systems, we're not emotionally perfect human beings, large numbers of people are going to want a psychoactive drug of this type, does it not make sense that you try to steer people, to provide them with the kinds of information they need to know which is the least dangerous of these, if they're bound and determined. I mean, it gets back to your question.
But
my
then,
son,
now, now you're speaking as a medico again. Yeah. But if you're speaking as a legislator, what would you settle for? In other words, would you both settle for a reform of the laws that made it, let's say, a petty infraction, an English-type thing, £10, if you were caught smoking? Or would you say, no, I won't even settle for that?
I won't settle for that.
Why?
Because that's still...
It doesn't this satisfy the people who say, at least now there is a minor penalty, and therefore one feels a profile of corporate resistance to it, which is consistent with your resistance?
No, because one is still saying it is a wrongdoing, and you are morally condemned. Furthermore, this way, it seems to me that if it is legalized with controls, let's say having it available at 1.5% tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the active euphorian substance in marijuana, we have an opportunity that way to minimize the dangerous aspects of the drugs. I mean, the adverse reactions, for example, the anxiety, the panic reaction, is very often a function of overdosage. Now, kids picking up stuff on the street may get marijuana, which contains 0.5% tetrahydrocannabinol. Some Panama Red, which Mr. McKinney sent off to be analyzed, had 4.2% tetrahydrocannabinol. This is a
4.2.
Now, this, and a kid picks up some of this stuff, and he's getting a dose which is more than eight times what he's been accustomed to, and he just has no way of dealing with it.
It's sort of super hashed, I think.
It isn't hash, but it's a super marijuana, you see. Now, if it were regulated and people knew what to expect, this kind of adverse reaction would be minimized. Furthermore, I'm convinced as I read the literature around the world that the so-called panic reaction, paranoid reaction, which a small number of people who use the drug experience, is very largely, in a drug where set and setting are so important, a function of the fact that the smoker in this country is smoking it in a hostile setting where, in fact, he can be arrested as a deviant criminal. In parts of the world where the laws aren't as severe or aren't as strictly enforced, one seldom reads about this kind of thing.
Are you saying that the statistics are different among the people who are pushed into, catapulted into a form of schizophrenia, among societies in which it is forbidden and societies in which it is not forbidden?
No, I'm not talking about schizophrenia. That's something else again. I'm talking about a transient paranoid reaction that a person feels very frightened that...
When you refer to the quotes, the last straw in precipitating a schizophrenic break...
That's different. I'm talking about a different thing there. You're talking about functional psychoses, which is another matter altogether. Then the final thing that this will...
Well, what about that? I mean, are there figures on that? Let me ask you this quite plainly. Are there figures that show that more people go berserk from smoking marijuana when it is forbidden than smoking marijuana when it is not forbidden?
There are no data to demonstrate that.
And are you inferring anything?
I'm not inferring anything about schizophrenia on this point. On this point, I simply wanted to make one other observation, and that is that... that by also controlling it and legalizing it with control, one eliminates the adverse reactions which derive from the fact that some samples are laced with other more dangerous materials. And here again, now you may say, okay, well, what prevents someone from going out and buying bootleg marijuana?
The answer is, in fact, they don't much.
Just as they don't go out and buy, they can go out and buy ethanol, or they can get it from a laboratory. We have laboratories where people could get ethanol, but they just don't. They don't take it. They can go to the liquor store and buy 86 proof scotch.
Well, Mr. McKinney, didn't you once tell me that in fact you can get an overdose by the simple device of taking quality controlled stuff and simply smoking more of it?
Well, it's hard to call it an overdose because,
like alcohol.
Yeah, exactly. There's a common misconception that people who smoke marijuana smoke to utter intoxication, which is the same way the Carrie Nation felt about alcohol, that, one drink and you're a drunk. Actually, the great majority smoke it. If they smoke it, they smoke it in moderation. Occasionally, though, they will smoke and smoke and smoke and smoke and smoke, and it gets later into the night, and they can get really stoned out.
So therefore, if we narrow it down in terms of Dr. Grinspoon's point, if it were legalized and freely available, anybody who overdosed himself would be doing so intentionally.
Intentionally, rather than accidentally.
I would say that without a doubt.
Yeah, and what percentage of the people who who in fact use marijuana today, would you say, accidentally overdose themselves?
Well, it's hard to say. The frequency of these reactions is not, these adverse reactions is not very common. The data from the Haight-Ashbury Clinic demonstrates they're not very common. In something like 280,000 consecutive admissions to the Los Angeles County General Hospital, there are only several, I think, three marijuana reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And two of them were due to injecting stuff into the vein.
Well, then it's not very important.
It really is, except for this. The people at the Haight-Ashbury are very experienced, relatively experienced marijuana use, and they're less likely to have an adverse reaction.
Mm-hmm.
It's people who are inexperienced. And for inexperienced people,
I would argue, okay, we're worried about this set of people. Now, we legalize marijuana, and it's available in any vending machine. The number of people who will then proceed to overdose themselves simply because some people overdrink,
mm-hmm,
is going to exceed numerically the number of people who accidentally do so now.
Mm-hmm.
Then isn't the social argument against you?
That depends. I mean, if you think that the total number of people who smoke marijuana
would increase
if we legalize, I think it would, but I don't think the difference is going to be that great. I think the increase in the use of marijuana is going on geometrically now, and I'm not too sure.
Yes, the amount that's being confiscated, the amount of dollar sales that have been reported are going straight up. I will say, however, that it's my opinion that this is going to go down, that in those countries where marijuana is freely sold...
Well, it has to go down. It's going up geometrically.
Yeah, it's a curiosity thing.
Anyway.
And in those countries where marijuana has been smoked for generations, it is not considered a very popular intoxicant. It is smoked by those who can't get anything else, like in India, occasionally ceremonially, by Brahmins and things like that. But as it is not a very powerful drug, doesn't seem to be a very powerful drug, it's not used very much. I think that we have a tremendous curiosity in this country that's leading an awful lot of people to try it, and it's considered a hip thing to do.
Try it once?
Yes, try it once or try it twice, or do it on the weekend. You know, the banker, I smoke pot on the weekends. I'm cooler than you are. Because it is illegal, and it's sort of, you know, anybody can get it, but it's illegal. And that leads me to a point I wanted to make, that if it were just minimally illegal, then you'd have the basis of selective enforcement, which we do have now, where, in fact, in any large city, you could probably go on a house-to-house search and just arrest right along until you couldn't fill your jail any further. And that's why they don't do it. Nowadays, marijuana arrests are usually limited to dropping two or three bricks in front of a policeman, practically. But anybody can be stopped in a car and searched, and he finds the smallest amount of marijuana can be put through a rather horrendous string of legal procedures. And if it were minimally illegal, the policeman wouldn't have any reason to go out searching for it unless they wanted to find somebody.
Okay, let me ask you this. You are suggesting, and I know you suggested as well explicitly on other occasions, that there is a tremendous lag, a cultural lag, if you like, between the medical findings of which you are aware and social policy.
Oh, yes.
And that lag either shows that the democratic mechanisms are extremely rusty or it shows something else. Now, I want to explore that something else.
I'd love to.
Could it be? Why is it the American Medical Association isn't on your side? Why do you expect to convert us laymen before you've converted your own colleagues? Why don't you have the whole of the medical profession saying to us, for God's sakes, cut out this crap involving marijuana legislation?
It's a very curious history, the American Medical Association, with regard to this drug. It was very good on this drug up until 1937. Beyond that, during the 37 hearing, the Marijuana Tax Act hearings, the only sensible voice before Congressman Dingell's committee was that of Dr. Woodward, representing the American Medical Association. And he said, in effect, look, you're saying it causes a criminal act, but you haven't got anybody from the Bureau of Prisons to present the data here. You're saying it causes children to do awful, but you haven't got anybody from the Children's Bureau here. You haven't presented any data. You've simply used newspaper accounts. And he was... he became persona non grata in that hearing very quickly. Then, nevertheless, the LaGuardia study was undertaken, and in 1942, two physicians, Drs. Alan Tuck and Bowman, published a paper. They were two psychiatrists working with the LaGuardia Commission, in which they pointed out it was a relatively harmless substance. The Journal of the American Medical Association wrote an editorial applauding this paper. That was in 1942. In 1943, they published a paper from Harry Anslinger, the first commissioner of what was then called the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, in which Mr. Anslinger said, this book is dangerous. It leads to all sorts of...
Did he cite medical evidence to back him up?
No, he really didn't. And then shortly thereafter, the American Medical Association wrote an editorial in which it condemned now the work that it had before applauded and said that this is going to lead to great destruction of law enforcement efforts, and it's the book is not scientifically sound and so forth. It did a complete about face. Now, it's continued to do that. The paper, a very recent one, the one from Philadelphia, is by Dr. Kalansky and Moore, is a paper which I think from a scientific basis is all but meaningless. Unfortunately, socially, it'll have great meaning because already there's a judge in Florida which says, well, here's real medical evidence of the real dangers of this drug. I'm going to throw everybody who comes into my court now in jail on a marijuana charge. I'm convinced that if the American Medical Association were less interested in using marijuana in the marijuana issue as a way of imposing a kind of moral hegemony with regard to this drug and more interested in the scientific aspects of the drug, it would never have published that paper. But somehow it has taken this position. It reminds me of the position the physicians took on the question of masturbation about the turn of the century. I mean, if you read that literature, you know, it's a great moral issue. And you read about how it would degenerate the brain.
These were
medical doctors writing about masturbation. It would destroy achievement. It would lead to something we now call the amotivational syndrome. I mean, it could almost be the same papers that are being written by some doctors on marijuana. And it strikes me that doctors somehow have always played the role of sort of the quasi-scientific handmaidens of the moral hegemonists. And I think to some extent, to a very large extent, that's going on with marijuana.
Well, all right. You get somebody like, say, Dr. John Pollard, who on the whole approves very much of your book, but he thinks that you're very naive in suggesting that it's possible to at once legalize marijuana for people 18 years old and over, and expect that it would be outside the reach of 17-year-olds, to which I suppose the answer is it's not outside the reach anyway, right?
It's absolutely
It's available to anybody, yes. Anytime, anywhere right now.
It's not as available as Lucky Strikes, is it?
Yes, I would say so, well, certainly.
Ask these people, they'll tell you.
Is there anybody here who couldn't get marijuana if you went in, say, within 6 hours if you wanted it?
6 hours?
6 hours.
Well, hell, you can get Lucky Strikes in 6 seconds.
That's true, but we won't. I'm just saying, you know.
You said as available.
You have to. Supposedly, those machines say you can't use them if you're under 18. But I think Dr. Grinspoon's is correct. If you do have it legal for people 18 or over, you're going to have the same thing. I mean, you know, I went out and tried to buy beer when I was 15 or 16. You know, you try to do these things. People do. And there's going to be some people, you know, standing at the corner of the street saying, hey, would you buy me some marijuana?
Yeah.
It's going to happen. But at least you're not going to have them buying the marijuana from the character who's going to offer them God knows what else besides, of God knows what strength, and God knows what quantity.
Well, what is your argument, then, for making it illegal for people under 18?
Well,
is that simply a medical guideline?
Well, I think that it... these are the people I'm most concerned with respect to marijuana, are young people, very young people. I think that while we don't have any evidence that it is very damaging to them, it stands to reason that people who are adolescent young people whose egos are not fully developed, whose egos are in sort of a fragile state, whose psychological development is not, or emotional development is not complete, that it stands to reason that it would be better if they avoided many experiences which they may not be prepared for. I don't mean just marijuana, but an alcoholic debauch or a sexual experience they're not prepared for. And it strikes me that while we won't have an absolute way of controlling this, it seems to me we'll have more leverage if it's legalized, because You know, just as a young man who 13, 14, 15 years old is just dying to drive an automobile, we say to him, not explicitly, but we say implicitly, look, we don't think you've got the right motor development yet, maybe the right the ego development, what have you, the right reflexes, but when you get to be 16, then we believe that you will have these, and you will be able to drive legally. And I think similarly, if we say to young people, look, we don't believe, and we can then have the right kind of educational programs, if it's legalized, mm-hmm. to say candidly, in a way which is credible, we don't believe that you are ready for this kind of an experience. But if you want to use it when you're 18, then that's your choice. You know, it strikes me, too, that many young people use the illegality of marijuana as a banner. That unites them, and if it were no longer...
Why should they, if it's so easy?
Well, this is the point I was going to make.
Yeah, I can understand a banner existing among people who do things that are really dangerous and hard to do. But if, in fact, it's as easy as getting lucky strikes...
Well, the thing is, there's still this incredible gap. Let's remember that marijuana as a drug was, for all practical purposes, not used in this country. Back when it was made illegal, there were pockets of groups in Harlem, among the immigrants especially, in the border states, down along in Louisiana. But for all practical purposes, it was a drug that wasn't used. There were some reports of the hashishins or the assassins and so on, but it was basically something that was smoked in Persia by people with hookahs or maybe hopheads in Harlem. And it became suddenly then illegal. Something which wasn't being used by practically anybody was suddenly made illegal. And then, out came these incredible stories of how evil it was. It was like, say, for instance, alcohol had never been used in this country to any great extent, and all of a sudden, all the information came out from the WCTU. The result of which is we have the adult population in this country has an almost gut reaction to the word marijuana that goes far beyond anything else. I mean, quite frankly, not more than 2 hours ago, a friend of mine, there are people looking at the television screen right now to see what I'm going to say because they had this immense family argument over whether marijuana was a hallucinogen or not. And although there's a lot of material available where these parents could go into any library and find out whether it was or not...
No, they couldn't because people disagree.
Well, not really. They call it a mild hallucinogen because if you stare at something long enough, I suppose it will move. But, the LaGuardia report is there. Dr. Grinspoon's book is there, and it's just voluminous. But it's a tremendous thing where you can go to your parents and say, I am doing something which separates me from you. It's a separation thing. When you're about 18, it's not that you know really what you want to do, but you got an idea that you don't want to be the child of your parent forever. And you've got to do something, like swallow a goldfish. It doesn't have to be dangerous. That will let your parents know that, by God, you are, beginning to show your oats. And this has become an easy way to do it.
Well, wouldn't it become just as easy to do it then at age 17? Because it would still be illegal.
It would still be illegal.
If the adolescent impulse is there, there are always going to be ways.
I don't think that's a terribly important. I just added. I don't think it's a terribly important point. But I do think that we are likely to have more leverage if we say, you can use it when you're 18 if you wish to, mm-hmm. rather than use it.
Now, what are the mechanics by which you advertise your findings in your own profession? Obviously, there is a sense in which by merely writing this book, an obligation is imposed on those of your colleagues who are called upon to give advice on marijuana to read it, right? Now, beyond that, feeling as you do about the gravity of the problem, what further steps do you propose to take in order to popularize your findings and in order to force people to consider the advisability of repealing or modifying these laws?
Well, I think that... I don't know that there's much that I can do for...
Well, in Massachusetts, for instance, that's supposed to be rather progressive, the legislature there, right?
Well, as a matter of fact, I've testified before...
What kind of reaction did you get?
Mostly hostile, just as my appearance before the President's Commission, the National Commission on Marijuana, was greeted in not a very friendly fashion, I think.
Was there a presumptive hostility, or did they...
Well, as a lawyer in the audience said to me afterwards, they questioned you for almost an hour, and not a single question was not hostile. It seemed to me quite clear from the questions that we're being asked by the commissioners that that their bias was very definitely against my viewpoint, whereas, let's say, I understand, although I wasn't there, but even the newspaper, the Times reporter, they were quite impressed and friendly to the position of Kalansky and Moore, these two psychiatrists who presented this data on the... Now, I'm not surprised, you know, that this is so. After all, President Nixon appointed 9 of these commissioners. Their average age is 54, and... it's clear that their views are I think, for the most part, pretty well established. In fact, the executive director of the commission, Mr. Sonnenreich, said before the commission began its hearings, and he came from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, he said, I can write the report right now. So that I'm very skeptical about what the commission is actually going to accomplish. In fact, in a chat... over a drink afterwards with one of the commissioners, I got the sense that his concern was that what we have to do, whatever report we write, is going to displease some people over here and displease other people over here, and we have to write the report. He didn't say this explicitly, but clearly the concern came from that we have to write the report that will displease the fewest few people.
Well, now, in a situation like this, where does one go from here? Does one simply say, well, let the problem overwhelm society... and let the anti-marijuana laws become a dead letter simply through atrophy? Or are you in a position to point to another society, England or France or whatever, and say, okay, over there it's legal. Let's keep very careful figures on what happens there during the next 5 or 10 years. Is there such a society
there
to
really
which you
isn't.
Can point?
There really is not.
Why? Why should we be unique? Why should the entire world be resistant on this?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the reasons is that marijuana, until we made it illegal, was really not illegal anyplace else. And Harry Anslinger was very proud of the fact that after we made it illegal, he had it written into a multinational treaty that everybody made it illegal. Now, India, for instance, had grave doubts. They said, if we make marijuana illegal, it's just going to cause a great black market. We'll make hashish illegal because it's very strong, but we can't possibly make marijuana illegal because they've been smoking it since the beginning of time
around
here.
This was before they made alcohol illegal?
Yeah. Alcohol is illegal because it's a religious thing. It's not, Muslims don't drink alcohol. And
it was only made illegal about 15 years ago.
Yeah. And it was a popular thing. And of course, like, you know, it's not being done. It's very popular to smoke, drink scotch in India, of course, because it's illegal, and it's British, and it's against the religion as well. But we have, through the instigation of our own anti-marijuana commissions, written this into multinational treaties. Now, we would be facing a great deal of embarrassment, not only for the literally hundreds of thousands of people who have been persecuted and put in jails and fined, and even if you haven't put in jail, the amount of money you can pay to lawyers is incredible if you get busted for smoking marijuana.
We'd be embarrassed if what?
Well, if we made it legal, because then who would be going around saying, gee, I'm awfully sorry to all those other people? And then what we say to the United States, to all these other countries that have joined us in wiping out the menace, if we said, well, we've changed our minds, and we're awfully sorry we asked you to sign that thing back in 1939 or whatever it was.
Do you think that's real? I don't think that's so realistic. You might make communism illegal, and then a different age moves in, and you legalize communism. You don't feel that...
I don't think we're going to change the laws, what I'm trying to say. I don't think the laws are going to be changed.
Do you think we're going to have to take the lead over here?
I think it's going to...
What about places like Sweden? Or no, better still, Holland.
What's happened in Holland, it's an interesting story. It was reported in Science about a year and a half ago. It's illegal in Holland.
It is.
But the after the young people succeeded through, what were they called? I can't remember. A provo succeeded in getting rid of the mayor and the commissioner of police in Amsterdam. The new mayor and the new commissioner set up the clubs Paradiso and Fantasia, I believe they're called. And there was kind of an unwritten understanding with the authorities that pot would be allowed in these clubs, but nowhere else. Now, very interesting things happened, as reported in Science. First of all, the kids did use pot. The managers of these clubs were quite responsible about other drugs. Out they went if they used any other drugs. The Dutch New Left became quite upset because it felt that kids believing that now that they've got their pot, they no longer had to remake Dutch society, and they were concerned about this. A researcher by the name of Cohen, H. Cohen, reported he had some data on the consumption of marijuana in Amsterdam before and after this, and he reported that there was not a significant increase in the consumption of marijuana, as nearly as he could determine.
There was not?
There was not.
Mm-hmm. Could that be simply because the clubs were not available to everybody?
The clubs were available to anybody over the age of 16.
I see. Mr. Lieben.
Well, I've always been convinced that the argument marijuana leads to heroin use is just very superficial and very specious. And it was like saying, if you started out in Little League, you might very well become a Major League Baseball player.
Right. Yeah.
But listening to the discussion, you mentioned that there is some relationship to sophistication and the use of heroin. And Mr. McKinney mentioned that people who need a sort of oblivion, you know, might very well have more of a chance to use and become addicted to heroin. Is it possible that marijuana may lead to heroin? I mean, is there a good argument to say that it won't?
It's certainly possible. Okay?
Oh, it's certainly possible, you see, but it isn't that marijuana is causal. I mean, the
post-pop drug.
Exactly, you see, and this is what, in fact, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. Now, this is their main argument. They've given up the criminogenic that leads to sexual debauchery, and so they've given up these arguments pretty much, but that it's the stepping stone hypothesis. But what they do is that you can take a group of heroin users, and you will find among any group of heroin that the use of marijuana among those users, you will find between 50 and 90% of them have used marijuana. But it's like, you know, and Emerson said that to be great is to be misunderstood. He did not mean that everybody who's misunderstood is necessarily great, although those who are understood would have it that way, perhaps. But the Federal Bureau of Narcotics does take it that way. Now, in the studies, prospective studies, data which is available, there is no evidence that this is the case. In a more recent study by Slater in England, he found that he looked at not just how many of these heroin addicts, this population of heroin addicts had used marijuana, but how many had used amphetamines, how many had used alcohol. He found that 66% had used marijuana, 66%, the same figure, had used amphetamine, and 88% had used alcohol. Now, nobody tries to make the claim that if you use amphetamine, you're going to go on to heroin, or if you use alcohol, you're going to go on to heroin. It's just with this drug that claim is made. Now, it is true that there are some people who, because usually of a character disorder, are bound and determined to go on to, will get to heroin, and almost regardless of anything. And it stands to reason that on the way they're going to try everything else, and undoubtedly they will try marijuana, but they've also tried Pepsi-Cola and milk and a few other things.
We have a gentleman on this program, the hippies, famous hippie doctor, out of Ashbury, yeah, and he said that approximately 5% of the people who start using alcohol become alcoholics, and these figures are 2 years old. Approximately 5% of the people who try marijuana go on to experiment with heroin, and that conceivably they're the same people.
I would say that's very likely, because let's remember that both alcohol and heroin are depressants. They're both drugs which slow down the nervous system and take you away. And people who use marijuana generally say it involves them more with what they're doing, which is not what the heroin user wants. He wants to get away. And this is again why I say it's a specious argument, because a person looking for getting away is going to try marijuana, and he's going to abandon it because it's not giving him what he wants. Mm-hmm. He's going to leave it aside and go looking for something heavier.
Ms. Ciplito?
Yes, Doctor, you said that you feel that there should be no penalty for marijuana. But yet many people of the black community feel that marijuana is enslaving them more, and that they feel that there should be a stiffer penalty for pushers and users of marijuana. How do you reconcile this with the black community?
Well, I'm not familiar with that sense that black people think that marijuana is enslaving them more.
Well, they do think that the drugs as a whole are keeping them down.
Well, I think
you're
talking about heroin.
Heroin.
Aren't you talking about heroin and
marijuana? Heroin as well as marijuana, because marijuana is greatly used on the streets.
They are giving you the argument that it's the white man who is getting rich off drugs, which is enslaving the black man. Mm-hmm. It is these same people who say that abortion reform is trying to wipe out the black people because they have so many extra children. Mm-hmm. And it is basically an idea to keep them from allowing them to grow to a larger percentage. Sure. If you're a persecuted minority, there are a lot of things you can point to as being agents of your persecution. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that any member of the black community feels that any kind of drug is going to be detrimental to them. And they are no more sophisticated than anyone else, and they probably feel that marijuana is as dangerous as some of them believe it is.
So then you feel that what would be the best asset would be to use Mr. McKinney's method of education and then to legalize.
That's right. I mean, in a very real sense, black people are enslaved by the marijuana laws. I mean, in the December 12th, issue of the New Yorker, 1970, though you may remember the story of a black man by the name of Johnson in Houston, Texas, who began to kick up his heels as a black militant, and the authorities decided to put him away. They entrapped him with one marijuana cigarette, and he was put away without probation for 30 years in the penitentiary. The New Yorker points out in that article that the white man who committed murder about the same time got 2 years probation. I think that's a kind of enslavement, and I think it's no accident that the laws against the use of marijuana are much more severe in the South, generally speaking, than they are in the North. For example, in Georgia, a young man 21 years of age or older giving some pot to his girlfriend who is under 21 can go to prison for life for first offense, can be executed the second for the second offense, and there's no provision, naturally, for the third offense.
It was pointed out to me by someone in California that the second offense penalty at this point in California is something like 30 years in jail, which apparently is also the same offense, the same penalty for unpremeditated murder. Mm-hmm. And the Dr. Skip Gay of the Haight-Ashbury Clinic pointed out that if you've been busted once and they busted you again, you might as well, you know, shoot the officer because the penalty would be the same anyway, which is, you know, to point out the ludicrousness of the laws. As I said, if we could educate people, say that marijuana is not that exciting. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to use it. It's not that exciting at all. I mean, if you want to go around and sit around and smoke it, you know, it's going to hurt your lungs. You're not going to be able to concentrate too well. But, you know, if you're that silly.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Kvyat.
Mr. Buckley, isn't it true that the president's opposition to the legalization of marijuana is based more upon politics than medical evidence, meaning that in order to satisfy his anti-student constituency, which he has in part created, he has to oppose the legalization, no matter what medical evidence shows?
Well, you're talking about a man who signed the bill that extended the vote to 18-year-olds. So I don't think it automatically follows that he believes that people, simply because they're students, are going to be anti-Nixon. I think on the contrary, he is probably persuaded, as most people are, of a national presumption. And that national presumption is that as long as you've got doctors disputing among themselves the question whether marijuana is dangerous, the thing to do is to hold off. We are, as I said, another connection, a society which has just recently made the drinking of tab illegal. Now, if we're going to find that illegal, there are an awful lot of arguments for saying that something to push you over the schizophrenic edge ought also to be illegal. I think it is the role, actually, of legislators to be conservative. My own inclinations on the matter are that it is preposterous to have such laws as Dr. Grinspoon and Mr. McKinney have finished describing. This I see no excuse for, but it doesn't, in my judgment, automatically follow that it ought to be legalized. Maybe it should, but I would prefer to go via the English route, during which, for a few years anyway, you make the penalty relatively exiguous, but keep it on the books so that there is some sort of an institutional standing on something concerning which we don't know.
I think it's probably a good idea, sort of a cooling off period when some good studies could probably be done with a little less of the paranoia that is so prevalent now.
Well, that's as I say, that's my own inclination, but I think that would understand make Mr. Nixon's attitude. Well, on the other hand, I agree with Dr. Inchman that one ought to be pretty impatient with a commission that starts off by by saying what are going to be the findings that he's going to come up with. Now, actually, would you feel that Mr. Nixon had moved considerably if his commission comes out in favor of drastically reducing the penalties and he goes along with it? Wouldn't you say this is a move, at least in what you would consider the right direction?
It's a move in the right direction, but unfortunately, it's still a medical problem that the president is looking to solve according to his political needs.
Yeah, but there are medical people who disagree with Dr. Winston. That's
and of course, don't forget, Nixon has made the public statement that he will not legalize marijuana. He's made that statement.
Well, in the first place, it's not in his power to legalize.
That's true. I will go along with that.
Yeah, I mean, he's become pretty experienced at being overridden by the Congress.
He did say that with regard to his own commission, I believe at the May 1st news conference in San Clemente, that even if the commission recommended legalization, he would not accept that recommendation.
Well,
but he's really...
You object to that.
Well, I do, because, you know, one option that the commission could come up with is that it should be legalized.
Yeah, right.
And the president said, well, if you come up with that option, you might just as well stop working.
It is not a part of American history, and certainly not a part of his constitution, that a president should delegate to a commission the right to decide of what it is that he ought to recommend. It is purely advisory. And he simply says, I guarantee to read the findings of the commission, and perhaps it won't influence me.
I think that the president has more than adequately in the last few years demonstrated his lack of need of advice from people, things like that. He's a very intelligent man, and he generally makes his own decisions.
Well, he consults. I don't know whether you're being sarcastic. I think the question is, how many people does he consult?
And, well, he's got this police dog which sniffs things out on his lawn. I've seen that on television.
Well, yeah, that's right. One never knows who is the redundant counselor.
I know.
And if you're president of the United States and you have a serious decision to make and you consult 20 people, should you have consulted 30?
Yeah.
And are you derelict because you didn't? That's, or might you just consult three or four?
And who to consult and who's got to answer, yeah.
So this is simply a matter of personal style. Actually, he has systematized the gathering system of advice better, I am told, than anybody else has, i.e.
That's true.
He becomes more aware of more points of view than, for instance, Lyndon Johnson.
That's quite true.
Which is now constitutional to reveal as of 2:30 this afternoon. Ms. Liebman.
Well, obviously massive drug education is needed. Where do you begin?
Quite frankly, our first programs were aimed at the 8th grade because we figured it was there that the knowledge filtering down was going to start actually getting into experimentation. But after we did that, we had so much request, we thought it over, and we, at least our creative learning group, is providing workbooks down to kindergarten.
Why don't you give the address of your group for people who want to hear more about it?
It's 145 Portland Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We're now taking it now down to the point at kindergarten where we're saying don't eat berries, don't go into the medicine cabinet, and in the second and third grades, what a doctor, what a prescribed prescription is, what aspirin is. These are drugs. These are things that change your body. You should not use them unless you have a specific reason for it. About the fifth and sixth grade, we talk about how emotions can affect you and how people try to use drugs to change their emotions. And I would say if you start, you know, literally at the elementary age, explaining something which has never been made clear to us, that we are living in a society, like all societies, which is full of drugs. Some, there are drugs and caffeine and nicotine and alcohol and barbiturates, and we just sort of like say, well, they don't exist. I would like to, you know, get right down as early as possible and say there are these things which we use sometimes to help us. Some people use other drugs to make them feel happy or sad. But get it right from the elementary school right on up.
Thank you, Mr. McKinney. Thank you, Dr. Grinspoon. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.